Boiling Frogs Post presents Geopolitics with Ryan Dawson. Now, with the latest podcast in this series, here is Ryan Dawson.
With all the hollow talk about Iran building nuclear weapons and being a threat to world peace, one must stand in awe at the audacity and hypocrisy of Israel, which tries to hoard hundreds of nuclear weapons, which it acquired by routinely stealing technology and material from the United States, and in the process left radioactive pollution in Pennsylvania. Israel has a multitude of lobbies unregistered by FARA. They've stolen classified documents multiple times. Most recently, there's the video release of former NASA employee Stuart Nozette selling secrets to IAI, Israel Aerospace Industries. Of course, more infamous is Apex, Wiseman, and Rosen stealing documents about Iran. The country has open state-sponsored terrorism, ethnic cleansing, and a standing internationally illegal military occupation. They actually are wiping a country off the map, and yet nothing happens. Every year, they receive more money from the American taxpayers awarded to them by the U.S. government than any other country in the world. Their sitting Prime Minister, Bibi Netanyahu, was himself involved in smuggling Krytons, nuclear triggers, with Heli Trading Company. Israel says jump and the U.S. says off of what? However, recently, the power of the lobbies and the PR machines has been slipping. Joining me today to talk about the lobbies and their history of organizing weapons theft from the U.S. and others is Grant F. Smith, the Director of Research at the Institute for Research in Middle Eastern Policy and the author of Deadly Dogma, How Neoconservatives Broke the Law to Deceive America. You can follow his work at irmep.org, irmep.org. Mr. Smith, it's a pleasure to have you on the program.
It's great to be here.
Well, I was initially going to open up with some questions about the NUMEX scandal, but this new video release of IAI bribery and spying is just too juicy. Can you explain what happened there? Who's Stuart Nozette and what did he do that his attorney denied?
Sure. Let me give you a little background on this. Stuart Nozette was a NASA official who had access to all sorts of Star Wars, Reagan administration missile defense, and classified satellite information. After he retired from government, he set up a nonprofit organization called the Alliance for Competitive Technology, and he began using his connections. He was still he still had security clearances to do consulting work, and so he got into trouble in terms of overbilling some clients and was overheard threatening to divulge all of the classified information he had accumulated over the years. And so he also had a very suspicious contract with Israel Aerospace Industries, a large state-run defense contractor in Israel, which is paying him $250,000 for certain tasking that they were giving him. So basically, the FBI and Justice Department set up a sting where someone posed as a Mossad agent and recruited Nozette, and then video recorded him agreeing to sell $200 million worth of defense secrets for a 1% fee. And so,
how is he hiding that money? Just saying he's getting consulting fees or something?
Yeah, it was very, very clever. He was the kind of only person behind the Alliance for Competitive Technology, and he was saying, well, we're trying to foster better technological innovation through sharing. And so, unfortunately for him, you know, receiving basically consulting checks and then running them through the nonprofit left a money trail. But it's unclear whether he was getting other types of funding from Israel Aerospace Industries. He said several times during the sting, the FBI sting, that he had already thought that he was working for Israeli intelligence through Israel Aerospace Industries. And so whether they had also been paying him cash is an open question. But the video that we acquired shows him quite happily accepting $10,000 in cash for having given some secrets to an undercover FBI person. So that he was in that business and able to hide the cash. He was bragging about being able to hide the cash and talking about laundering it through Singapore and all this. So, you know, it's interesting because this video that went out a couple days ago was something that they played during his sentencing last year. And a couple of news organizations like Bloomberg wrote about it, but they didn't make any effort to actually obtain the video. And so there are some clips out there from the Washington Post that were, you know, obtained from the Justice Department about the time he was, about the time he pled guilty. But no one ever went after the more incriminating video of him actually pocketing money and talking about, you know, more mechanics about the espionage with the undercover person.
It seemed routine, too, because he said in that video, "Do you have anything for me today?" And then he handed him a wad of cash. So it seemed like that had definitely happened in the past. And it
yeah, well, he doesn't even – yeah, he says, "Do you have a token for me today, like a token of your appreciation?" It was kind of weird. You know, you've watched the video and you have – kind of these two, you know, this, it sounds like a New Jersey accent, you know, we're talking about this, you know, the undercover agent's voice is not masked on this video, and they were very comfortable, very engaged, and Zet's laughing, and he's talking about how he's crossed the Rubicon, and, you know, he's saying, "I'm yours now, so, you know, I'm going to give you the whole thing, I've got hard drives of classified information stored in safe deposit boxes," so, he was really revealing himself to be, you know, very, very much excited and you know, calling it a career change over all of this. And so, you know, it's astonishing to watch, particularly, you know, tie into the AIPAC convention that's going on or that was going on this week, particularly since the U.S., has funneled so much money into Israel aerospace industries. I mean, this is, you know, a defense contractor that is jointly developing the Aero missile defense system. And, you know, from the perspective of people who want accountability, it's clear that the Justice Department should have flipped Nozet and said, you know, we're going to go after Israel aerospace industries. But of course, they didn't do that.
Well, often when Israel spies on the United States, flipped agents or not, it doesn't really seem to matter. It really comes up.
No, but they would have done that if it had been a Chinese defense contractor, and they certainly would have done it if it had been, you know, anything to do with Iran. There would have been an effort to kind of get to the bottom of it and not hermetically seal off kind of Nozet and the Alliance for Competitive Technology and only, you know, only go after that aspect. You know, the funny thing that you see if you go through the other clippings on YouTube, when this thing broke, it's almost as though Fox News and NPR and all of the others had been issued by the Justice Department a statement that they had to repeat every minute that they were talking about the story, which is there's no indication the government of Israel was involved. There's no indication the government of Israel was involved. And that's, you know, that's clearly not true.
It's their own state-run industry on the other end of the spy ring.
Exactly, and had already paid $250,000 and has the had the means, motive, and opportunity to do it. I mean, during the time that they were most active in tasking Nozet, you know, they were trying to get a bigger chunk of the total contract for developing this missile defense system. And so, you know, Nozet was just a happy circumstance for them, somebody who was, you know, excited to do this kind of work. But clearly the entire motivation for what he was doing came from IAI. And, you know, Israel Aerospace Industries, although no one ever mentions it, has been doing this for decades. They were founded by a convicted felon who made his bones by obtaining Lockheed Constellation aircraft for pennies on the dollar after World War II and turning it into a smuggling airline that successfully created a Panamanian front company for a number of these planes and then collapsed it and flew them overseas to smuggle arms from Czechoslovakia to Palestine. And so that's the founder of this company. Later, they were involved in stealing Dassault's plans for their jet fighter and helping Israel create its own platform. Rooms of plans, you know, just giant quantities of plans. They were involved in Iran-Contra in some aspects. They were involved in all sorts of things. And so,
and a lot of those guys from both Iran-Contra and from the ZOA guys got pardoned after being caught.
Well, absolutely. Al Schwimmer was pardoned relatively soon. What you see in the documentary record is that some of the early smugglers who were smuggling for the, you know, War of Independence in the 40s, Al Schwimmer, Hank Greenspun, Charles Winters, all of these people later received presidential pardons. But they were definitely crooks. And Hank Greenspun, who later went into the publishing business in Las Vegas, his FBI report says that they were involved in bribing jurors to get lighter sentences. And in this case, he never went to prison and later got a pardon. So there's a whole lot of corruption involved in the fact that such major arms traffickers, you know, just violating the Arms Export Control Act and Neutrality Act willy-nilly, never really faced any consequences. And indeed, it helped their reputation with their foreign patrons.
Yeah, Charles Winters smuggled in some B-17 bombers, B-17, which, you know, at that time was high-tech.
Yeah, it was. These things cost $250,000 to develop back in the day. He acquired them because he wanted to have a fruit business, you know, bringing in tropical fruit between Florida. And he had sort of demilitarized some B-17s to haul cargo. You know, those were still very valuable in terms of being able to retrofit them and use them. And so, you know, this whole history is surprisingly well documented in declassified Justice Department and CIA documents. There's a 7,000-page archive in Maryland in the new National Archives 2 building, which have photographs of the B-17s and the Lockheed Constellations. They have all sorts of information about Jewish agency funding for the airliners. And, you know, the investigation only managed to convict a handful of people. And if it had been done right, if they really wanted to uphold U.S. laws, then they would have literally arrested hundreds and hundreds of people, including a lot of lawyers in New York, including a lot of on-the-ground people all over the country. But instead, they just let it all go. And our argument is really that we're in kind of the state we are today because it's now assumed that this sort of impunity is going to continue indefinitely, that you can pretty much do anything you want if you're righteous.
Yeah, and even some of the convictions that they got weren't, I mean, they'd go to jail for maybe 18 months for crimes like that, which should have been for life or years, you know, a little bit.
As far as I can tell, Charles Winters is the only one who ever did time for the actual conventional weapons smuggling. As far as I can tell, Greenspun and Schwimmer, the former Israel Aerospace Industries person, never went to jail. So they had fines instead. But, you know, it's really interesting to read some of the declassified investigation files because it, you know, the people who were sort of the lantern-jawed FBI people on the ground following all this knew that the pressure to quash all these prosecutions was being applied on the president by lobbyists like Abraham Feinberg, you know, the mythical man who had funded Harry S. Truman's whistle-stop campaign and was instrumental in moving massive amounts of money around from Truman to the LBJ administrations. They knew that he was putting together a war chest and an entire group of people to pressure and make sure that none of the people centrally involved in moving the money were ever prosecuted. And they won. They managed to keep a lot of people from ever even being indicted. Nahum Bernstein, who actually wrote the checks for some of the planes, was a prominent lawyer in New York, and he was moving all sorts of cash around, and he just operated with just this absolute aura of impunity. He had, some of his former law partners became district attorneys, and he had New York police on the payroll. So he was kind of one of these people who was operating above and beyond the realm of anybody who actually, could be indicted.
And then it was Truman's hand-picked Attorney General Thomas Clark who basically put the kibosh on making ZOA comply with FARA, the Foreign Registration Act.
That's a really interesting story. The Zionist Organization of America, which was instrumental in passing, kind of like AIPAC and some of the organizations have done today, if you go to state legislatures, you see that a lot of them have passed resolutions about Iran. And so, what the Minnesota state legislature has in terms of interest in forming a foreign policy towards Iran is beyond me. But if you look state by state, a lot of these groups have done what they managed to do back in the day in terms of resolutions for the creation of a Jewish state in Palestine, have done the same thing, same playbook, get lots of resolutions passed in state legislatures and develop momentum towards whatever the policy of the day is, whether it's, attacking Iran today or back in the time of the Zionist organization in the 30s and 40s, it was, the creation of a Jewish state in Palestine, passing resolutions, collecting money. And then, of course, some of their people were also involved in arms smuggling, such as Rudolf Sonnenborn, who met with David Ben-Gurion, who asked him to put together a network of people to give him arms and move some of the huge surplus World War II materiel that was coming on the market as surplus, move that overseas through shell companies. And so there was a clear connection between organizations claiming to be harmless nonprofits like the Zionist Organization of America and the arms smuggling. They tried not to mix the money together, but they were clearly using their clout in terms of their massive membership to pressure for and then later work for statehood. And so you have the Justice Department and State Department, which administered the Foreign Agents Registration Act, for seven separate occasions ordering this organization to register as a foreign agent since they were under the control of the World Zionist Organization. And yeah, as you said, they made a deal with the top person of justice. And, that really shows how political DOJ attorney generals are, made him basically overrule the staff attorneys and the career people, as I'm sure never happens here in Washington, but overrule them, kind of stab them in the back and say, you know what? ZOA doesn't have to register. Didn't give any sort of statutory justification. Didn't cite any new findings because all of the professional research had already been done about the control relationships. And most concerning, the fact that this foreign entity could order the ZOA to engage in, quote, special activities, unquote, to support the state. And so they wanted it registered. They wanted it openly regulated. They wanted, 6-month reports filed about budgets and political activity. And the ZOA said no. And the Justice Department pretty much had to take that.
Yeah. And they were instrumental in smuggling the conventional surplus World War II weapons from the War Assets Administration to Palestine. And they used a number of fronts. Other Israeli companies like Zim Shipping to ship these things off. And they were literally having like explosives fall out on the piers in New York and things. It was very dangerous. It could harm Americans.
Well, it was. That's exactly what got law enforcement interest onto them in the first place, was the fact that, they're mislabeling all of these crates and sending implements of war overseas. But a lot of these companies, and there's just an entire raft of them, were nonprofits or for-profits, and, there were many of them, machinery processing and
Mining Company, Foundry Associates, Machinery and Manpower for Palestine, Service Airways, Machinery and Metals Company, Martech, Palestine Vocational Service, Western Trading Company. I mean, just the list goes on, and every single one in the network was picked up in the Justice Department's investigation in this 7,000-page archive I'm mentioning. But many of them were allowed just to shut down, and many of them were allowed to kind of convert into ostensibly legitimate organizations to, you know, function as purchasing agents for the new IDF. So I think it would have been good for the Justice Department to actually revoke or attempt to revoke the corporate charters of a lot of these corporations. And I think it would have also been good if they had done the same thing with Stuart Nozette's organization, the Alliance for Competitive Technology. But that corporation, although it's defunct, it's not because anyone loudly and clearly said in the state of Maryland, we hereby revoke the corporate charter of this front company. It never happened. You never see that sort of thorough type of effort made.
And because ZOA got away with, I'm just saying, I mean, there's all those things you just named, but I'm just talking about sort of the organizing factor. But because they did get away with it, essentially, that probably upped the ante for them to start stealing nuclear technology and nuclear material, which they started to do. I think the last people to go after Israel's nukes were the Kennedys, and nothing since then. But why and who botched the investigations or assisted in the cover-up for ZOA? And stealing the material and the NUMEX scandal. Can you talk about what happened in Pennsylvania and Apollo?
Sure. So 1958, Apollo Industries was formed in Apollo, Pennsylvania. And this had two ZOA officials, Yvonne Novick and Zalman Shapiro, along with Elliot Finkel, who was a corrupt Justice Department lawyer. He'd been forced out of the Justice Department. He became the chair, the national chair of the ABL later on. And David Lowenthal, who is a smuggler in the Haganah conventional arms smuggling days, and a blockade runner with very close ties to Israeli intelligence. And so they put together a couple of companies, Apollo Industries and the Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation, in Pennsylvania, Apollo, Pennsylvania, really nice little town outside of Pittsburgh, and began offering fuel conversion processing services to the U.S. Navy.
Just to reiterate, because the volume was a little scratchy there while you were talking, he said, in 1958, Apollo Industries was formed by two ZOA officials, Zalman Shapiro and Yvonne Novick. Also, Elliot Finkel, who was the chair of the ADL later and was a corrupt Justice Department lawyer, got kicked out of the Justice Department. And then David Lowenthal, who was a smuggler and a blockade runner. And they set up the Apollo Industries as well as the Nuclear Material and Equipment Corporation, which we refer to as NUMEC, in Apollo, Pennsylvania. Zalman Shapiro is a famous chemist. He did a lot of work in the Nautilus Project, which is for the first nuclear-powered submarines, and that's how he had the connections to procure the contracts for the nuclear fuel for the Navy for these subs. Of course, he was diverting it to Israel. So how much U-235 are we talking about?
Over the course of their operations, they lost 339 kilograms of weapons-grade uranium. It's still
good
the assessment.
Lord. How do you cover that up?
well, you say that because you only had $4,000 to start your company, that you're a sloppy manufacturer and that you just polluted the environment. And that has a certain ring of truth to it, because the site is undergoing a $500 million cleanup right now. But,
is that true, though? Were they so sloppy that caused the pollution, or did they pollute it some on purpose to cover for the uranium they were stealing?
I think it's a combination of the two. They were certainly utterly not incompetent, but they didn't care about the environment or the workers. And there are wiretaps of major spills taking place just because they were out of compliance, but not because they couldn't have done better, but because they just didn't. Their priorities were
basically getting material out of the U.S., and they had a 10-year window to establish a flow of material and divert a certain percentage of it. And there's not really any question. I've never heard any credible argument saying, no, they really did lose it, particularly because you have eyewitness accounts of diversion. You have top Israeli and nuclear weapons officials visiting the plant during times of uranium loss. And so there's no doubt in the evidentiary or documentary record that material was being diverted. There's even, you know, a newly discovered visit by the Department of Energy to the head of the Atomic Energy Commission saying, yeah, we picked up traces of this material supplied to NUMEC in Israel. So there's, you know, there's no real doubt about that. The question is what you just asked. Why didn't the government ever do anything about it? And, you know, when you see the reaction of the Johnson administration, they just didn't want to deal with it. LBJ, when he was told, basically said to a CIA director, I don't want to hear about this and I don't want you to tell anybody about it. Nixon was kind of the same way. They knew about Zalman Shapiro, particularly since when he left this company, NUMEC. He tried to get a job at Kennewickie Borelco Industries to get access to the U.S.'s most advanced miniaturized hydrogen bomb designs. And they had to engineer a way for that not to happen without, you know, stepping on the toes of the lobby. And they were, you know, the documentary record shows they were extremely concerned about not having public relations backlash in the U.S. for either of the two challenges, getting Zalman Shapiro away from U.S. nuclear secrets, and then later they didn't want to be penalized if they withheld Phantom fighter jets from Israel in an attempt to pressure it not to go nuclear. And so that's why we have this, you know, idiotic policy of nuclear ambiguity where presidents go mum anytime the question of Israeli nuclear weapons come up.
Did you meet with Jonathan Pollard's handler at Apollo right outside of NUMEC? I mean, how does he explain meeting with Mossad agents and losing uranium?
Yeah, he's never explained why he invited Rafael Eitan in to visit and why he told the Atomic Energy Commission that Rafael Eitan was an energy specialist, which he's not. He didn't ever explain why he invited Shin Bet operative Avraham Bender in. And that's the amazing thing in the documentary record, is that those obvious questions were never asked, even when he was interviewed by a member of Congress.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this sounds just like Wiseman and Roseman at AIPAC, and you know, no hard questions. You know, Larry Franklin went to jail, but the two guys actually stealing the secrets, red-handed, caught red-handed, and they got fired from AIPAC, but nothing really happened. I mean,
well, you know, I would disagree on two points. If we jump ahead to the AIPAC espionage case in 2005, there are some similarities. Just to wrap up on NUMEC, though, it's still the Government Accountability Office's official view that there was never any credible investigation that took place. And that's true. They just did not find it politically convenient enough to investigate and have any sort of accountability over NUMEC. It was what one reporter, John Fialka, called the self-sealing issue. Congress was interested in it. Constituents were interested in it. People who live in Apollo were interested. But it was never in any politician's or political appointee at Justice Department's interest to really resolve the issue. And if you jump ahead to the incidents where two AIPAC officials, you know, dialed up Glenn Kessler of the Washington Post with evidence that Iran had attacked the United States, and in, you know, Rosen's view, Stephen J. Rosen's view, that this was, you know, a way, this was evidence that the U.S. had to respond, and this is what he was hoping for. That case, I think, was a watershed. And actually, there was, I would say, just the fact that it came out so quickly, and the public became aware of it so quickly, it was a watershed. Because if we go back to the 40s, people didn't really know about all of this smuggling that we were talking about, the arms, the shipments, the docks, the airplanes, the smuggling.
Well, there was no internet yet, you know. But I was going to point out Johnson's attorney general was the son of Truman's attorney general. I don't know if that had anything to do with why they weren't interested in it, but...
Well, I'm sure they, yeah, I'm sure they knew who, you know, that's a funny thing because, I'm sure they knew who to tangle with and who not to, but it still took 25 to 30 years for there to be anything like broader public awareness of what had happened. And in the case of NUMEC, you didn't really have much information, much hard information coming out until the late 70s. In terms of when AIPAC stole the trade secrets of 70 organizations lobbying against trade preferences for Israel in the middle of the 80s, nobody really knew about that fully until 2010 when the FBI files were released, although some people knew about it because they were their secrets being used against them. But there's something about when Stephen Rosen was calling the Washington Post to, you know, get this pretext for war against Iran rolling, just the fact that they were there was an FBI investigation and indictments, and people found out about it relatively immediately. That was a change because it kind of stopped that particular campaign to entangle the U.S. in a war with Iran, kind of stopped it in its tracks. And, you know, you mentioned the internet as being a reason for that, and I think you're probably right. You know, a lot of the establishment media organizations are so terrified of doing any legitimate coverage on this issue that if it had been just left to ABC, Fox, and the others, and they knew that if they kept their tongues that nobody else would ever find out, that then probably, you know, who knows what would have happened. But, you know, instead it was a big deal, and alternative media kept it into, you know, in the spotlight until Obama quashed it in 2009.
Right.
So that's, you know, that was at least 4 years of public scrutiny of AIPAC. And then, of course, Stephen J. Rosen sued AIPAC after the criminal charges were dropped, arguing that it defamed him. So, you know, I think there's a major difference between kind of what these organizations can get away with now and what they could get away with, you know, back in the 40s and 50s. I'm not saying that.
Oh, it's definitely improved compared to how it was, but I'm still, I mean, it's nowhere near satisfaction. I'm not sure if NUMEC's really over. I mean, what about the people on Apollo? Is there any court cases or anything? I mean, because they polluted that town with radiation, shouldn't they be able to take them to task, or are they just taking on too many New York lawyers, or what's going on there?
Well, the situation is tough because the environment is polluted, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has kind of taken over from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. A lot of the citizens and environmental groups around Parks Township and Apollo, Pennsylvania, right along the river there, are really dissatisfied with the way the cleanup has been handled and the way wrongful deaths for radiation sickness have been handled. And so they're happy that the Justice Department, or excuse me, that the Army Corps of Engineers is coming in and overseeing the cleanup. They've managed to get some defense appropriations when John Murtha was in place to fund health concerns and, you know, kind of say these were the cold warriors who are helping us get a nuclear navy. And everyone has found it to be in their best interest to steer around the diversion issue and pretend that NUMEC was not a smuggling front and that nothing ever happened. And in terms of court cases, there are a whole bunch of civil court cases against the companies that acquired NUMEC after most of the smuggling occurred. But they are also steering away from the entire time period when it was independently owned by, again, these Zionist Organization of America.
But didn't it, this new startup tiny company do a joint venture with the Atomic Energy Commission in Israel? I mean, isn't that a red flag?
Yeah, I thought it was a red flag. They had a joint venture with the key front organization for Israel Atomic Weapons Development Organization, which is the Israel Atomic Energy Agency. So they had, you know, this joint venture necessitated the shipment of irradiators, which look like kind of like big waste baskets full of, you know, ominous markings of radiation on the outside. It necessitated the shipment of a lot of those, you know, under extreme security and LL airline shipments and shipments from New York piers on Zim ships.
That's a it pretty dangerous way to do it. Just throw it
well,
in a container?
It's, you know, if you're going to ship U-235, what you don't want is somebody opening them, and you don't want to put anything like that in a bonded warehouse where some pesky customs official might not believe that it's an innocent shipment. Actually, you're not supposed to ship an irradiator with anything inside of it. So you're supposed to ship materials separately from equipment. But what was seen by a NUMEC employee in the 1960s is that Zalman Shapiro were seeing stuffing a bunch of U-235 canisters into an irradiator and then shipping the irradiator on a, you know, out by ship.
Israeli ships.
And not go through a bonded warehouse. The ISO-RED joint venture was a pretext for having to ship things to Israel. And, you know, it
didn't last very long. As soon as it was acquired by Atlantic Richfield, they didn't value the venture at all. They gave all the stock back to the Israelis and said, we don't want to have anything to do with this.
And so that kind of shows what they thought of it. But it provided a pretext for shipping containers, kind of like after World War II, aid to displaced persons necessitated shipments by these charitable organizations, boxes labeled clothing and, you know, machinery and all of this, which were actually in reality full of ammunition and explosive blocks purchased, you know, again, for just pennies on the dollar as World War II surplus. So, what is it, you know, is it over? I don't think it's over. And, you know, what you've seen that's really interesting in court is that longest running foreign agents in the United States for legal help is actually defending the companies that later acquired NUMEC. And so it's kind of
they acquired your liabilities as well when they got them, I guess.
Yes and no. I mean, they when NUMEC was transferred to Atlantic Richfield and later Babcock & Wilcox, contractually they were responsible for any liability since 1950. It's my understanding, though, that liability policies don't cover criminal activities. And right. So if someone were to go to judge and say, look, this was a smuggling offense, and so all of these cleanup costs have to be seen within the context of a criminal activity. What we have here is not a cleanup site. It's a crime scene. Mm-hmm. And so if someone made that argument, it would probably actually be better for Babcock & Wilcox and Atlantic Richfield. You know, I'm not defending their operations of the smuggling company after they acquired it, but it would probably be better for them if that argument and said, look, you know, we can't be responsible for a $4,000 operation that was principally designed to smuggle uranium. That's not something that we should be held to account for. And all of these liability policies can't pay for that kind of thing because that was outright criminal activity. And so if they went to court with that argument, they might actually be defending the interests of their shareholders a lot better than allowing the principal foreign agent for
or the Israeli company that comes in whenever an Israeli official is charged in U.S. courts for war crimes.
So they've kind of thrown away their best legal argument. What firms are involved here?
Arnold and Porter, which is this firm I've been referring to, has been representing the Israeli government since June of 1964. Dismissive lawsuits against Ariel Roan, against various Israeli military officials. They've been paid up to $500,000 a year by the Israeli government. They're on a $10,000 a month retainer. And curiously, they're kind of managing all the lawsuits in this small town in Pennsylvania. This powerhouse global DC-based firm has somehow found it possible to become involved in these NUMEC lawsuits, and they're slaughtering the plaintiffs who are trying to get health compensation. So that's a real problem. The big issue with NUMEC in Pennsylvania is that everyone's steering around the elephant in the room, and that is the smuggling past and origins of this plant, and the press is afraid of it. Reporters on this issue in and around Pittsburgh and Apollo know the backstory, but they don't want to report on it because, that doesn't help them as businesses. So there's a real problem. This is what you get when you agree, such as, Joe Biden has even said this in a Zionist Organization of America meeting overseas. He said it's important that the U.S. and Israel never air their disagreements in public. And this is kind of another instance of why that kind of secrecy allows, real harm and real corruption to just breed. NUMEC should have been resolved back in the early 70s. There should have been massive arrests. They should have taken down the plant basically as soon as they found out what it was, instead of just allowing it to just, keep polluting. And they should have made an example out of the organizations and individuals who were running it, and they should have asked for the uranium back.
I just don't see how it went on for so long if they were missing so many hundreds of pounds of uranium. Like, at what point did they decide, oh, that's too much? And if you are, okay, say you're not smuggling it, you're losing it and polluting, well, then you still need to stop. Like, I don't get why it could go on for so long, other than it involved Israel, so they let it go.
Well, the nature of oversight was pretty lax. There was, in terms of the supply contracts, it was a Ponzi scheme. So they would get, mm-hmm. A few hundred kilos of uranium to process for a job. But then before they were finished, they would receive another few hundred kilos for another job. And so what was being siphoned off and sent overseas was not immediately noticed because they were being hidden with and rolled over into new contracts. And so only when they couldn't renew their supply contracts, only when it was beginning to catch up with them because the losses were so big, only then did it become apparent that there were massive quantities of materials unaccounted for. So, if you look at that,
that makes sense. Or, I mean, that...
Yeah, if you look at that compared to a financial crime, it's pretty much the same thing. You can hide these things for decades and decades before they blow up, but they will blow up. And this one, instead of confronting it. You can really see it in the documents when Henry Kissinger is advising Richard Nixon what to do. And some of these classified memos of Kissinger and Nixon only came out relatively recently in 2009 and 2010. And very few people have examined them closely. But they didn't want to pay a political price. They didn't want bad press. And they knew that if they suddenly started, hammering people responsible for diversion, that is exactly what would happen. I mean, by the end of, skipping ahead to the 2005 AIPAC brouhaha, by the end of that process, you had major organizations and newspapers accusing the FBI of anti-Semitism, rampant, ongoing institutionalized bias.
Now, and why is that? Like, why can something that ridiculous even stick then or now? I mean, we have a foreign government stealing from the United States. That should be news, and it shouldn't hurt the reporters at all. Now, I know it's true, I mean, I agree with you, and I agree with Kissinger too. But why is it that such a hollow accusation to say, look, you're anti-Semitic, which is a prejudice against an ethnicity, because you are talking about what a country has done to another country? I mean, there's no relationship between the two.
I agree. I'm not saying that it's an argument that has a lot of, you know, intellectual firepower behind it. All I'm saying is that people are afraid to be on the receiving end of it. That's all I'm saying. And, you know, if you do look at the news clippings, they were coming out of the Washington Post. The Washington Post took an institutional stand that Rosen and Weissman should not, you know, that there should be no trial. And there was a massive media campaign. In fact, the Reporters Guild even filed briefs in that against any sort of special handling of classified information. I mean, you had this massive and sometimes behind the scenes intervention by media to, you know, really affect the trial and make it more difficult, as opposed to saying, okay, well, let's see what this process brings. There was no interest in having the AIPAC officials on the stand and a judge, you know, looking over what they had done and making any sort of judgment. The issue, the effort was to shortchange it, and the Washington Post and other newspapers were leading the charge. If you look, there was definitely, you know, many accusations about, you know, how this prosecution could even come about and how it was, you know, just a result of bias. And
I know, I remember reading them, but they were all lame. I just don't see why I'd fear it. I know they do, but I wish more people would just do the right thing, because people calling you names or coming up with these lame excuses as they did for that cover-up is just, you know, nothing really to fear. I mean, the press can say all it wants.
It's a matter of conflation that works. I mean, it's certainly not the only lobbying organization that would do something like that. I mean, if you were calling for example, real oversight and prosecution for violations of, you know, SEC regulations, you would be hit back with charges that you're, you know, trying to undermine capitalism or finance. I mean,
yeah,
conflation,
too big to fail.
Yeah, but I mean, conflation is the name of the game, and so the Israel lobby has been doing that forever. You know, and you know that
yeah.
as
it
well
also,
as other...
they involve a lot of the big banks and MMIC corporations too, because like a lot of the foreign aid to Israel is earmarked to be respent on U.S. arms, etc. So it's really like the Japanese would call a zaibatsu of organizations that play off one another, because
sure.
One policy feeds into the other for profiteering.
I don't know if it might look more like a karitsu,
sure.
Sort of Japanese mafia or kazuka.
Yeah.
I don't know what they call
yakuza.
It. I'm not in Japan.
Yeah.
So. Yakuza, right. You know, it certainly has all the familiar attributes. But, you know, I think one of the reasons we've got such lousy mainstream reporting, and I would include the Nezet video in that as just the most recent example, is... there's been an ongoing campaign to really try and get friendly journalists in place and organize media boycotts if there's a news organization that's digging too deeply. I mean, they're so exposed and so vulnerable that they've found it in their interest to pretend that none of this really exists. And you know, going back to NUMEC, I read probably every major news piece about NUMEC that was ever written. So in reviewing every single major news piece about NUMEC, you have reporters suppressing the name of the plant and its location. You have the New York Times doing sensational, accurate headlines overseas and bland, ultimately forgettable ones in the U.S. You have people long associated with... you know, kind of covering for Israel, writing speculation that it was an approved CIA transfer of U.S. material. I mean, just stuff that, in retrospect, it looks like garbage. It looks like, you know, not serious investigative reporting. And then the serious reporters like John Fialka covered it intensely and then were never never revisited it. They never followed up on it. They'd write a few stories and not go back to it, even as new developments emerged. So total media fail in terms of putting NUMEC into the timeline of Israel's nuclear weapons development and getting stakeholders, meaning taxpayers, honest government employees, people who live in Apollo and parks, stakeholders, any sort of accurate assessment of what's going on. And it's really shameful. And there still hasn't really been any recent reporting. I mean, we've managed to kind of like the Nazette videotape, we've managed to get a lot of documents that have never been released, shedding new light on putting that GAO report 1978, which was not supposed to be classified, but was the CIA insisted on getting it classified. But there has been no reporting beyond what's gone into antiwar.com, no reporting beyond that. So major revelation after major revelation as freedom of information laws permit the declassification of documents, and no media interest in it whatsoever. So it's we're still in the same situation that allows this sort of thing to happen, the sort of complicity in terms of a lot of the establishment outlets in not, you know, not covering it.
Well, I'd say the establishment media, but I consider antiwar.com and this show as media. I know what you mean, like televised media, but I think it's making a difference. I think the lobby's power is slipping considerably. They've had a couple recent fails recently. Wouldn't you say they are starting to fall apart? I mean, I know they weren't very happy about Chuck Hagel getting nominated.
No, they weren't happy about Chuck Hagel. And I think they're really in a bad spot, because one of the good things that's happened, moving from mainstream media to U.S. public opinion, is that ever since sort of the big revelations about the fact that the rationale for war in Iraq was made on false pretext, ever since that time, U.S. public opinion, according to Gallup, has been going against mainstream media, and 60% don't trust it at all anymore, which is, you know, pretty, I say that's pretty good. And the problem the lobby has right now is really the fact that public opinion has gone against them in terms of the Israel-Palestine issue, where according to a Chicago Council poll that came out last year, and some recent ones as well, more than 60% of Americans don't want to take Israel's side in that conflict. And so you've got in the same poll, Americans, 41% saying that U.S. aid should be decreased or stopped altogether, and 45% saying that it should be kept the same. And meanwhile, the requests for exemptions from sequester and ever more military aid keep going, and they keep getting it. And so the lobby's challenge right now is American public opinion is swinging against them, because Americans are more educated, thanks to, you know, I would say the decline of mainstream media, more educated about it, and they don't want to be complicit in it anymore. And so I think, you know, whether Hagel turns out to be a good Secretary of Defense, or he kind of, you know, takes some of his brilliance and does a Robert McNamara, who knows? You know, anything could happen. But what's not happening, what doesn't seem to be happening, is any reversal since the beginning of the 2000. Doesn't seem to be any reversal number of Americans who are looking at all of this and saying, no, I don't want to be complicit in it. So I think that's a good thing.
I think the ones that are saying no, though, are saying it with an exclamation point now. Whereas before, they're like, oh, I'm against that. But I mean, there are some people who are very aware. I mean, with the Palestine issue, I mean, without being just blinded by religion or something, I don't know how any rational person on earth could say, yeah, ethnic cleansing and racial colonization, that's fine. I mean, nobody would agree with it if they knew about it. It's just all a matter of getting them to know about it.
Right. But I mean, you know, I think nobody, except for those who have been writing the stories and pump the propaganda organ, I don't think anyone has any idea just how much effort has been made to dehumanize the Palestinians and tell a story that has so little basis in fact that Americans, you know, if they believe it, they have no choice but to want to support the Israelis, you know, surrounded by Arab hordes. And, you know, one of the things that came out of in some Senate hearings back in 1963 was the extent to which the Jewish Agency was funding propaganda efforts in the U.S. All the major magazines were running stories pretty much written for Tel Aviv. And I don't think people, you know, at the time they were receiving it, realized what it was. But, you know, if they could read that and watch Exodus and receive all the subtle, you know, programming from Hollywood movies, which have a lot to say about this issue. If you read Jack Shaheen's book, Real Bad Arabs, you just see how
real spelled prevalent. With the E-E, like Hollywood real.
Yeah, it's an excellent book. And so I don't think people, once they know the amount of dollars that have been spent to propagandize, it helps, I think, because they get mad about it. But I don't think there's still yet been any sort of realization in terms of just how big and how prevalent this has been in the United States, this effort to...
But I think outside the United States especially, they've really lost their grip, because I think a lot of other places are recognizing how ridiculous it is to have a blockade on Gaza and the occupation of the West Bank. And then
I think you're right.
It's proving too.
I think you're right. It looks more criminal and more heinous from outside the U.S. Because, you know, again, unless you're watching, satellite TV, you're not really going to see how bad this economic warfare has affected, you know, regular people. You're just not going to know. But in, you know, Latin America or parts of Europe and Asia, they are going to see that. And then, you know, Americans wonder why, you know, the UN General Assembly, there's such anger. And of course, the lobby's going to spin it as irrationality and support for terrorism. So, you know, we're still on the receiving end of just really, cunning yet immoral propaganda on this issue. It's always being spun. And you know, it's not to say the battle's over. Just because 60% of Americans don't trust mainstream media, it doesn't mean that they're getting a lot of great information from the sources that we've mentioned. But at least they have access to it now. Before, they didn't have any access to it. So I think that's a plus.
Yeah, and the internet's growing. I mean, we have more social networking sites, we have more video share sites, we have radio programs like this, and I think the writing's on the wall. It's going to happen within our lifetime. Israel cannot just continue the way it's behaving currently anymore, just like the apartheid in South Africa. I mean, you just can't get away with it. They can't control all the media once it gets on the internet. So, I mean, really all they have left is the U.S. and Canada. Most of the world is against them. Politicians might not be, but I'm talking about the public. They're not
for right. Right. I think it's, the difference between having a tight grip on the politicians in one country on the basis of a coordinated network of campaign contributions, I wouldn't bet the farm on that either. I think it's naive to think that you can allow public opinion to diverge so much from public policy. And I think it's frankly quite dangerous from the perspective of people who are in the lobby and pushing a war in Iran, dangerous to be out trying to do that publicly. I think they've been forced to do it. I mean, you know, it's pretty common to hear people say, oh yeah, the Israel lobby wants a war with Iran, but nobody else does, which is accurate. Pretty stupid thing to do, though. I think being so clearly identified as lobbying for another kind of war that doesn't serve any American interest and is not based in any sort of real threat is that could be it. That could be the undoing of the lobby. But, you know, even despite the fact that their 2000 propaganda drive was thwarted, you know, indictments, they don't seem to have learned anything from it. And one can be ungenerous and hope they keep doing it so they ultimately drive over a cliff. Or one can be more generous and say, hey, you know, this is pretty stupid that you're claiming to speak for so many people and promoting such a harmful policy. But we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, we'll see. I personally think all the talk about Iran building a bomb is to justify the sanctions on Iran, but they don't really want to go to war with Iran. Not the U.S. doesn't. Israel does, of course. But I think they're just kind of walking that tightrope right now. But we'll see how it goes in the future. Of course, I don't want war, but I'd love the lobbies to fall apart. I say it with an S because it's a lot more than just AIPAC and ZOA and everything. But
sure.
Yeah. But I like the lobby from the book from Mearsheimer and Walt. But I'll tell you what, keep doing what you're doing. We're running out of time here, but you keep your press up. I'll be linking to you, and we'll grow the alternative media, so to speak, the real media that can tell the truth without corporate bias. And we'll see. We'll see the lobby fall apart.
All right, Larry. It's been a pleasure to be on your show. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. I'll have you on again in the future.
That was Grant Smith, ladies and gentlemen. You can get a lot more information and see the video we were referring to about IAI on his site, irmep.org.
Check back soon for another episode of Geopolitics with Ryan Dawson, exclusively here at BoilingFrogsPost.com. We'd like to thank you for your support of our work and invite you to share it with friends and ask them to support it as well.